Welcome to the ACG podcast on the Liver Disease and Pregnancy Monograph. I wanted to thank Dr. Rowe for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited.
So we can get started. What do you counsel on a pregnant patient who presents to your clinic with elevated liver enzyme?
Yeah, the first thing we talk about is really a differential diagnosis, just like you would approach any kind of problem. So recognizing that there are liver injuries or things that can show up that you had even before you were pregnant, things that are definitively linked to pregnancy, and then something that you could have acquired, like maybe a new medication, maybe just being a little bit dehydrated. And then I strongly emphasize the difference between a functional problem like liver failure or liver function abnormalities and lab abnormalities. Pregnant individuals are really worried. You've got two lives, right? Your own and the baby's. And you want to make sure that whatever is wrong is something that's not going to impact the health of your child. And so we talk a lot about what that lab test abnormality is and how it is in the context of your baby and your health.
With the increasing incidence of MAFLD in the population, you'll be seeing more pregnant MAFLD patients in clinic. What risks are you discussing with them?
Metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, or the big mouthful for fatty liver disease for metabolic reasons, is very common. So up to about 50% of Americans are anticipated to have MAFLD over the next few years. And even though our younger population is a little less affected, we still see quite a bit of MAFLD in our patients of childbearing age. So you're pre-pregnant. This is a really important time to talk about what MAFLD implies for the health of you and your child. So it does increase risk. There's higher risk of hypertensive complications of pregnancy. There's higher risk of preterm birth, of large to birth weight, and gestational diabetes. Now, if you are already pregnant, here we often talk about, you know, the importance of appropriate weight gain. Now is not the time to go on some radical diet to see if you can change your weight. You know, your nutrition is important for both you and your baby. So ideally, you want to find that in the preconception time. And then, you know, really emphasize how to risk reduce those things through diet and exercise, going into your pregnancy at a healthier weight and trying to have appropriate weight gain, you know, ideals so that we don't, you know, we have good outcomes.
Are you placing patients on GLP-1 agonists prior, like in the preconception time, to kind of help them get to the weight loss goal prior to pregnancy?
Yeah, so GLP-1s are interesting. For a hepatologist, I have limited ability to prescribe a GLP-1, although we do expect that we will get semaglutide for fatty liver disease or at-risk MAFLD possibly this year. Most of the time, I'm encouraging someone who has MAFLD and diabetes to talk to their diabetologist about including a GLP-1 in their diabetic platform. If you have, you know, obstructive sleep apnea or cardiovascular risk and obesity, then we talk about how to add a GLP-1 because they are going to be liver friendly, but we just don't have a lot of ability to prescribe them for your liver disease alone. Now, that being said, we definitely know that GLP-1s are important in patients who have a polycystic ovary and helping to regain, better fertility. And this is important when you're taking care of someone and that you've helped to put on a GLP-1. Sometimes if you're not talking about contraception, they will have an unplanned pregnancy because, you know, the weight loss or the agent doesn't help, you know, help with regular menstruation and improvement in fertility. But I'm not using these as a hepatologist to help risk reduce that patient in front of me unless they have another health condition that would be a good fit for a GLP-1.
Pregnant patients with hepatitis B, if they need treatment or prophylaxis, what is your agent?
So this used to be very straightforward. The guidelines universally said that you needed to use tenofovir in the form of TDF, and that entecavir was not advised. Our first generation oral nucleosides like lamivudine and telbivudine have risk of resistance, and they were not recommended. And that TAF was too new, so tenofovir in the form of TAF. Now we have growing information so that many of the guidelines still prefer TDF, that there's a lot of safety and efficacy around TAF. And so I would be comfortable using either one of these agents.
And if they aren't on medication, what is your threshold to start treatment and when you start treatment?
In the individual that presents, if they have clear indications for treatment independent of pregnancy, I usually start them at the time that I see them. Now, if the mother or if the, you know, if there's hesitancy, then you're going to start that agent in the second trimester. If they do not have indications other than to reduce the risk of maternal to childhood transmission, then you're going to check that viral load in the second trimester. If it's greater than 10 to the 6, that's when you're going to start their antiviral therapy. And then I continue it until labor and delivery. And then after delivery, then I have them stop. But then you have to clearly monitor for flares for about 3 to 6 months after you've stopped. Now, that clock on how you monitor for flares is independent of when you stop. So if you chose to continue for a month or 3 months postpartum, you're going to monitor them very carefully after you've stopped the agent.
If they are already on medication, do you consider switching medication if they are not on tenofovir?
If they are taking entecavir or a combination of medication that is not just tenofovir, then I would recommend that they switch over to what our guidelines would consider appropriate treatment during pregnancy.
When counseling patients that their newborn will need HSIG and HCV vaccine within 12 hours of birth, do you have any recommendations on how to coordinate that with their OB or with their pediatrician?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I would have to say that our OBGYNs are already very, very good about this. And I think just making sure now in the world where there's a little bit of vaccine hesitancy, outlining that the HBIC and vaccination within 12 hours of birth is really important and the main player in preventing maternal to childhood transmission. And if they seem hesitant, you know, I remind them that this is not a curable virus. And if their baby ends up with exposure that we could have prevented, that's going to increase their risk of liver cancer, of, you know, extrahepatic manifestations. And although we can control it and possibly cure it in that child's lifetime, the best thing is prevention. And, you know, there's millions of individuals who have been safely vaccinated. And there are entire countries where this vaccine protocol has been instrumental in decreasing liver cancer rates in their population.
Intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy is one of the most common liver diseases associated with pregnancy. For these patients, when do you start URSO?
So ursa deoxycholic acid is a choleretic, so it's going to help make the bile acid population a little less inflammatory and also the bile, you know, kind of come out of the biliary system faster. And you're generally going to start this after you've identified a patient with intrahepatic cholestasis. So remember, these individuals present with pruritus or itching a lot more than abnormal liver enzymes. And even when they have abnormal liver enzymes, they generally are not jaundiced. A jaundiced patient really is a different differential diagnosis. And alkphos is hard to interpret in the pregnant population because your alkphos is going to go up. So itching is the mechanism to then check bile acid levels. If the bile acid levels are above 10 and you want to do these in non-fasted state, then you are starting to think that this patient has intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. If they are hesitant to start ursodiol, then you can certainly wait a little bit until the bile acids look like they're increasing. You know, certainly by 40, I'm going to recommend starting an agent to prevent the bile acids from going up further, because that's going to have a stronger association with, you know, fetal outcome.
How often are you rechecking the bile acids?
So in the beginning, I don't check them too often, but by the time you're getting to, 30 weeks of gestation, then I'm going to start checking them weekly, because now it's going to impact the timing of delivery. We typically think of delivering around 37 weeks because most fetal demise that occurs after 37 weeks. But now we know that if the bile acids are getting to close to 100, that's also strongly associated with fetal demise. And so you want to make sure you find that opportunity to deliver before you run the risk of having an outcome that you could have prevented.
For patients that develop acute fatty liver pregnancy, do you need a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis?
Absolutely not. So histology is certainly an important role when you don't know what you have, and it would change how you manage that patient. So acute fatty liver pregnancy tends to occur in the third trimester and occasionally even postpartum. And so if you are really hesitant to, you know, deliver the mother because it's very early in the pregnancy, or remember that preeclampsia, eclampsia, HELLP, acute fatty liver pregnancy are on a continuum, and knowing what the diagnosis would change how you would manage, then you might consider a biopsy. But we generally use this all on you know, diagnostic criteria, recognizing that this is a very rapidly progressive disease, and making sure that you transition to delivery at the earliest time point when it can be done safely and avoid liver failure.
When you start to consider transferring patients over to a transplant center?
So I think that if you're in an area where your closest transplant center is very remote, you're going to want to make those phone calls early. You may not have to move your patient, but you need to know where they're going to go if things go poorly. Anyone who's coagulopathic, so if your INR is greater than 1.5, you're starting to worry. And, you know, certainly if your patient is demonstrating mental status changes or you're checking ammonia levels, which is a little controversial in encephalopathy, but, you know, or signs of multi-organ failure. Remember, acute fatty liver pregnancy also causes pancreatitis, acute kidney failure. So any early suggestions that this individual is progressing to something that's more severe, you want to move that to a tertiary care center where transplant is an option. But just knowing your backup, if you have a patient that's going to labor and delivery, is not coagulopathic, you know, having that conversation about, would you like my patient now? Or is it okay if we go through labor and delivery and I'll, you know, watch things very closely with labs every couple of hours. And then if they're getting better, no need. And if they're not getting better, then, you know, efficiently transferring for escalation of care.
In cirrhotic patients, what are you counseling them on in the preconception period?
So the most important thing in a cirrhotic individual who wants to become pregnant is to understand if they have clinically significant portal hypertension, because of all the things that happen in pregnancy with a patient with cirrhosis, it's really the risk of GI bleeding that is the most frightening. And so in this individual who's considering pregnancy, you want to do that upper endoscopy. And if they have varices, you want to address those varices. So if they're moderate to large, you're going to put them through endoscopic band protocol. And if they're small, you would probably think about starting a non-selective beta blocker. It's really that. And then a good history to find out if they've ever had an episode of decompensation. So even if they look really healthy now, if they have a history of decompensation, their risk of decompensating during pregnancy or postpartum is a lot higher. And you're going to not necessarily advise against pregnancy, but you're going to make sure that person's being followed by, you know, a high risk OBGYN, that there are very, very frequent touch points to identify complications earlier than later.
If they come already pregnant, are you performing variceal HPV surveillance, and when should they be getting these tests?
Absolutely. Preferably in the second trimester, if you did not have that upper endoscopy before, you know, you want to do that EGD to make sure that they know if you have gastroesophageal varices. And if you do have gastroesophageal varices, you're going to consider managing them. You're going to band them and then repeat, you know, endoscopy to make sure that the band ligation was effective. If they are small, then you would probably talk about a non-selective beta blocker, you know, to prevent them from enlarging. Most of the risk is really through labor and delivery. And when you're valsalvoing, putting additional pressure, although just late in pregnancy, you're going to have more pressure on your IVC, and that's going to increase the risk of variceal bleeding. And that's absolutely a life-changing event for both that mother and placing that infant at risk.
For post-liver transplant patients, when can they consider getting pregnant?
So ideally, we like to have excellent liver function and stable immune suppression. And so we argue about, is that a time or is that a state? So if it took you 5 years to have stable liver function and stable immune suppression, then maybe you shouldn't be getting pregnant when your drugs are constantly being changed. I would say for most women, it's probably around a year. What you don't want to do is to get pregnant very early transplant. And that's important because in your women that are, you know, potentially fertile post-transplant, if you are not talking about birth control, you will find that you have unintended pregnancies because, you know, menstruation and your endocrine function returns very nicely after a transplant. And you want to make sure that this is a time when you're going into things in a very controlled way, as opposed to haphazardly when they may not be as, you know, as stable as you would like.
What complications do you counsel them about?
I think they always worry about, you know, the risk of the medications. And, you know, we strongly emphasize that you still are going to need immune suppression during pregnancy. The last thing you want is an episode of rejection at the same time that you're trying to grow a healthy baby. And then the other things that we talk about is that, you know, our post-transplant patients do have slightly higher rates of hypertensive complications of pregnancy, probably gestational diabetes, certainly small birth, you know, size, early labor and delivery. And so making sure that they're, again, connected with high-risk gynecologic OBGYN is going to be very, very important. Sometimes you're also going to need to talk about the disease that they came with. So things like autoimmune disease, or if they had hepatitis B that led to their transplant, that can impact, you know, pregnancy management. But most of it is just going to be about the immune modulation that they need to continue and how you're going to monitor that with, you know, their changing blood volumes and things and the hypertensive complications. And this is a group where you probably would talk to OBGYN about prophylactic aspirin to decrease the risk of hypertensive complications.
What type of delivery would you recommend for these patients?
Yep. Most of the time, we would still recommend vaginal delivery if that can be done safely. So, you know, there are certainly exceptions if you have a person who had PSC and inflammatory bowel disease and might have had, bowel surgery. And then you want to make sure you talk to your surgeon if this is a person who had had repeated interventions or something about their anatomy makes, you know, labor and delivery more controversial. They have a big hernia or something, transplant. But outside of that, you're going to let the OBGYN determine the safe mode of delivery and not make it related to the fact that they are a post-transplant patient.
What would your main takeaway point be for this podcast?
I think the most important thing from this podcast is that liver diseases are scary and pregnant individuals are also scary. And when you combine those, it can be a little overwhelming for the care team. But most of these, you know, whether it's a liver disease that the patient had independent of pregnancy or whether it's a pregnancy-induced liver injury, that these are manageable. We just want to have early identification and preferably pre-pregnancy if it's something that the patient already had so that you can have an appropriate monitoring plan. And then for most of our pregnancy-associated liver injuries, labor and delivery is going to be the thing that solves them. But you want to make sure that the timing of that is optimal for good, you know, fetal growth. Not every one of them is an emergent labor and delivery outside of like acute fatty liver pregnancy or advancing severe HELLP. And so, you know, trying to have that open conversation with all of the individuals taking care of that patient and infant is going to be really important.
Thank you, Dr. Rowe, for joining us on this podcast.
Not a problem. Thanks for inviting me.